Hello, I am Paige Alviniak, editorial director at Promax, and this is the Daily Brief podcast. Today, I have the honor and the privilege of talking to Nico Desmordant. He is director of brand management at creative agency Gnet. Hello, Nico. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. So Gnet has actually been named Promax Games Agency of the Year for the past 2 years, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So let's, I've talked to Gnet before, but I don't think I have on the podcast. So why don't you tell me what Gnet is, what kinds of clients it serves, what its sort of unique selling proposition is?
Sure thing. So Gnet is a creative agency and production studio. We've been around for nearly 20 years, and all of that time focused in the game space. And over the past 3 to 4 years, we've been working more and more in the broader entertainment space. So streaming, TV, movies, et cetera.
So, and you guys, I've seen campaigns from you for Netflix, like you did Altered Carbon. I just saw the E! Campaign for, I think it's Flip It Like Disick, right?
Mm-hmm.
Any other TV clients that you can mention?
So yeah, we've been working a lot with Netflix, as you mentioned. We're doing more and more with E!, the Flip It Like Disick, and there's some other stuff that's right around the corner. And then there's a few other entertainment partnerships that I can't talk about just yet. Mm-hmm. But if you circle back in a few months, I'd be able to.
Okay. Yeah. We're in this conversation, we're going to sort of cover this intersection of games and entertainment. And then just as far as you're concerned, you're director of brand management. So tell me what that entails. What does that mean?
Sure. So my role as the director of brand management involves working daily with our senior clients. In addition to managing our brand team, which is often called an account team at other agencies. And that team and myself really operates as the direct line to our clients for all of our work. And we act as that kind of two-way filter between our agency and our clients, basically representing our clients' wishes and desires to the rest of our agency. We also work very closely with our strategy team, new business, production, and creative teams.
Okay. So yeah, it's also known as account management. I was thinking of it more as like protecting the client's brand, which I guess is probably part of the larger task.
It is. And that's a good way to put it. We used to be called an account team, and we purposefully switched to brand as we kind of take more ownership in representing what our clients are really looking for within the agency world. We are kind of upholding what we know and what we believe they want, and ensuring that at the end of the day, we're going to end up with something that everyone's happy with.
How often do you end up with something everyone's happy with?
That's a great question. It depends who you include in everyone.
Yeah.
I think we strive
and at any
to
moment in the
there.
Process. Yeah.
Exactly. We strive to always end up there, at least with clients and with agency. The one that's tricky and the one that we try to specialize and focus on is kind of the third corner of that triangle, which are the fans and the people that we're making it for, ensuring that they're going to get something that excites them and incentivizes them to either watch or to play, or to, at the very least, pay attention.
Yeah, we're going to talk about fans some too in this conversation. So you guys have done games for a long time. In the past 3 years or so, you've gotten more into the overall entertainment marketing community. How would you say the needs of games clients and entertainment marketing clients are similar, and how are they different?
That's a good question. You know, I think there's actually a large number of similarities between them. I think both mm-hmm. games and entertainment, they're in the business of stories, and they want to represent their story well to their fans without spoiling the best moments. I think one big difference that I've noticed is really the length of a campaign. Games ask their players to spend hours and hours and hours with them. And when a game comes out, oftentimes that game is relevant for months, if not years. So there's a need for a longer and more constant engagement to kind of stay top of mind. For some games, day one sales just aren't as important as how many people are playing 6 weeks later. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen so far in entertainment is that there's really a desire for people to show up and watch upon release, because a new show or new movie might be kind of taking the attention away in one of the upcoming following weeks. So you kind of need to strike while the iron's hot.
It's interesting because I think that with games, that community is so, I mean, A, they probably spend a lot of time in their preferred game anyway. And I think that they're very hungry for constant content. Whereas in entertainment marketing, well, one, I think the entertainment marketers or the TV networks would die to have that kind of engagement. I don't exactly know how you create it, but it's an interesting, it's sort of an interesting dichotomy, right? Like on the game side, you really cannot give them enough content. And on the TV side, they wish they could engage them more, but there's, you know, at a point there's only so much you can do.
That's right. And it is an interesting balance between the two. I think with some entertainment properties, they have the benefit of having just legions of fans who always do want more and will constantly engage. But, mm-hmm. you know, that is the exception and not the rule. There are, in today's day and age, there's so much entertainment that it is a challenge to kind of fight for that attention and to have consumers and viewers and fans who do want to engage or even just have the time to engage.
I think also, I'm just thinking about, like, I've played games before, and the people in the game, a lot of those, not a lot, but some of those people are in the game every day and have been for years. It's like that's who they hang out with, right. Kind of. So in that way, it's actually like their world. Whereas I'm thinking about like on a Game of Thrones, I think people would live there all the time if they could, if HBO would give them that content. There's other ways to connect with that world, but
right.
But it is an interesting thing in that games allow you to. I was also thinking about it in terms of world building, which was a question I had later, but I'll bring it up now. I was thinking about how TV shows would love to do world building as part of campaigns in the ways that games do. But then I was thinking, actually, any given TV show has built some world for itself. It might be a very common world that feels like your neighborhood, but it does have its own thing going on. So I think that's something that entertainment marketers can lean into if they want to.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. There's, you know, world building used to mean one thing. And to your point, I think that definition has definitely broadened. It's gone beyond what we used to traditionally define it. It used to mean, is there rich lore that I can envelop myself in? Like, tell me about all these different factions and what they believe in. But it can really be as simple as, tell me more about these characters. And every show has characters, and every show or movie is about characters. And that's a version of world building. And it's always going to be a fine line as to, you know, what is considered quote unquote canon and what is a character actually saying and believing in. But I think world building really has a place in all kinds of shows and properties, not just the ones that are, you know, traditionally bound or defined by having a rich lore.
Well, so sort of building on that, what are things that you are taking from your game experience to your entertainment marketing clients? What lessons have you learned from doing gaming campaigns that you think apply to entertainment marketers?
You know, I think it for us, it's really dependent on the type of show or movie that we're talking about. I hesitate to say that it's one size fits all. I don't think mm-hmm. that world building is right for everyone. Sometimes that just may not be that type of show where people really care about these other side characters. But oftentimes we do find that measuring those results and seeing what people are interested and invested in is something we do a lot of in games. And granted, we get the benefit of games have long tail campaigns. They come out and often they are relevant for long periods of time. And we can kind of measure and see what are people caring about. We have our expectations and we think we know what people are going to gravitate towards. And oftentimes we're right, but every time there's always something that we didn't quite expect, someone that people really love or enjoy that we didn't quite see coming. And the campaign and the creative at that point should pivot to recognize what fans do care about and give them the screen time, put them in the advertising, use them as that hook to show that, hey, fans, we get you. And also there's more content here that you're going to care about. I think that kind of measuring fan reaction and affinity is something that's often done in games, and you see it more and more brought into the broader entertainment world.
Yeah, I mean, two campaigns that I think I already mentioned. So the Netflix Altered Carbon and the For E Flip It Like Disick. I mean, that's two kind of good examples of how it's totally different. Like Altered Carbon did do a lot of world building. Flip It Like Disick is a reality show, so it's already like living in the real world, so it's a different kind of thing. But I do think it's interesting in a show like Altered Carbon, you probably do have a lot to work with there from a here, come be engaged in this world that's totally different from the world you know.
That's right. And for something like Altered Carbon, which is a, you know, science fiction kind of neo-noir type of show, it's important to show that there is a kind of deep experience and world that's waiting for you. You know, as I mentioned, we're fighting for people's attention spans all the time, and not just in marketing. It's really people's time that could be spent watching something else or playing something else. There's a lot out there, and that's only going to increase. So for something like Altered Carbon, when you have longer format episodes and a bunch of those episodes, even if I am a science fiction nerd and fan, which I am, I still want to know that the show is going to pay that off for me, that it's going to be worth investing my time in this. Is it going to be a rich world with interesting characters and places that I couldn't go to? Are you going to have those things for me, or should I take my attention span somewhere else? And I think a large part of that campaign and what we were trying to do for some of those core and science fiction fans was show to them and prove to them that, yes, this all exists here. This is a science fiction playground that you're looking for. Come join us.
Okay, so I'm going to switch gears a little bit to some campaigns that you guys have out kind of right now. One is Gears 5, which actually comes out today, I think, September
Correct.
5th. Yep, Call of Duty Modern Warfare. The beta for that comes out September 12th, correct?
Yeah, for early access.
And then Destiny 2 Shadowkeep, October 1st. So all three of these trailers I will put in the post with this. But talking about creating campaigns for game companies, so like these three that I just mentioned, and then talking about, you were just talking a lot about engaging the fans. So on one hand, you do trailers just like anybody else would do trailers for these games. But you also talked about engaging the fans and kind of going where those fans are. So can you talk about both creating the standard trailers for these campaigns and then also how you engage the fans around these campaigns?
You know, it's interesting when you say create the standard trailer, because you're not wrong. That is what a lot of trailer companies do and what we do often. But standard is now unique for each of these, for each of these games and for others. It really depends on the kind of property that we're working with and kind of where in the cycle that we're at. With something like Destiny, a game that's, you know, Destiny 2 has been out for years and there are constant and new content updates and upgrades, we have a long history of both working with this IP and measuring what fans are excited about, what they care about, and where they want to see the game go from here. It's a very different experience than something like a Gears or even a Call of Duty, where, yes, there's a history and a legacy with these franchises and these IPs, but they're sequels or they are entirely new games in and of themselves. So in terms of what we can do from a trailer perspective with something like a Gears or a Call of Duty, it's really more, at least in the beginning, about announcing and exciting and showing something brand new in terms of a game that's going to excite people and get them to jump back in. Whereas with something like Destiny, they might still already be playing. And granted, we're often going for that audience and more, not just the ones who are currently playing, but the ones who might have lapsed and played a few months ago, but haven't played since then. We need to convince them that now is a good time to kind of jump back in. So the kind of approach that we're taking with each of these trailers is going to feel very, hopefully, tailored to each of these games and these IPs and these experiences. But in all of them, at least the examples that you brought up here, it's all gameplay based. And the making of a gameplay trailer is a unique experience that both mirrors what you do in a live action trailer and is also completely unique and different.
Yeah, I had a question about that. So talk about that a little more, because with games, you're using the game engine to render these graphics and tell a story. With live action, I mean, sometimes people go outside the box, but often they're clips based, so they're using footage from the show. So can you talk about what it means to you guys creatively to both have access to and be limited to the game engine?
Yeah, it's both incredibly limiting and freeing at the same time.
That's how that works, yeah.
It is. And I personally love this challenge. I think oftentimes clients or different companies or people think that these blue sky briefs foster the most creativity. But in my career, I found that the opposite is true. Give me limitations, show me the lines, and we'll use every inch of space in the most creative ways imaginable. You know, I know we're talking specifically about game footage, but, you know, having a smidge of show footage means that we might need to take an entirely different approach to marketing than if we had all of the show footage and everything's in the can. You know, perhaps in that case, we're doing more of that world building and we're not using show footage at all. It's similar with a game engine. We're limited with what we can do and what we can show, but it really inspires the creativity as to how the trailer is going to take shape.
Yeah.
I think the best part about it is what we're ultimately going to show is going to be true and representative of the game because it's all from the game.
Yeah.
We have people who are actually playing the game and someone is acting as a DP in the game world and using a controller to mimic what a real life camera would be doing. We pull all the time from what people do in movies and TV shows and other kinds of marketing. We're just shooting it in the game world. And instead of actors, we have, you know, capture artists, people on the sticks, and they are controlling a character or an avatar that is akin to an actor. And everyone is kind of waiting for the capture director to say go, and then they all have their marks of where they're running to, where they're moving, and meanwhile the camera is moving through the game and capturing it all. So it's going to feel like an actual game experience, perhaps not your specific game experience, because I think everyone's game experience is going to be different when they actually get the game, and that's kind of the beauty of it. We can think about how everyone is going to play and everyone's going to experience this, and how do we put this game in its best light and be able to show them what your ideal experience or optimal experience of this game is going to feel like.
It's so cool. I just did a podcast where they basically took a Mercedes and shot it. They had a very high-end cinematographer, and he had a virtual reality camera, and he shot the Mercedes, but all in virtual reality. So it's kind of like what you're just describing, where you're like, you're not actually on the scene with cameras and all of that, but you're in the game with it. So it's just, it's a little bit mind-boggling. You know what I mean? It's you're actually in the game creating stuff out of the game. It's really cool. Do they have, like, what operates as a camera in that environment?
You know, it's funny. I just listened to that podcast, actually. So I know exactly what example and what reference you're talking about.
Okay, I hope everyone else does.
It depends on what we can get. So this actually kind of ties back into one of your original prompts, which is when you're kind of limited in what you have, whether it's in the game or whether it's in the show footage, how does that affect your creativity and the way you approach it? Every developer and publisher has a different set of camera tools. And sometimes we will, you know, have the honor of working with a publisher or developer for many years, and we will put in all kinds of camera tricks over the years, over the months. And sometimes we just don't have that luxury, and time is of the essence, and we're kind of working with what we have. There's generally a standard set of camera tools, but we do have our own I would quote, I'm doing air quotes you can't see, but our own proprietary version of kind of how we take what is considered to be a standard camera in a game and just apply tricks to it to make it look and feel differently. One of my favorite moments is being in a room with the people who spend hours and days and weeks and months and years making a game. And when they allow us to kind of get into their engine, get into their code, and start to capture, you can kind of see the looks on their faces change and morph as they see what is kind of possible when you allow someone to get into your game like this and capture in a way that they perhaps hadn't considered. We use many things that aren't traditional camera tools, but we turn them into camera tools. It'll mirror the effect without that being the original intention of the game code. And what you get is something that's going to feel like a very cinematic trailer without the developer having to insert or create a bunch of additional camera tools. As we know, developers and publishers are often on a tight timeline trying to get things done to actually put the game out there. So we do our best to work with what we're given and make magic with that.
So do all the camera tools that you guys use, is that usually already part of the game engine, or do you guys bring like BYO software?
It's a combination of the two. It's mainly what's already in the game. But like I said, we will take things that aren't standard camera tools that are in the game code and software, but the developers aren't really thinking about them as camera tools because
Right. Well,
that's not their job. That's not what they're focused on. They're thinking about that as an actual game mechanic. This is a scope that allows you to see something that is, you know, incredibly far away, a lot closer. That's a game mechanic. But we can also then use that scope as a camera tool, and it allows us to kind of zoom in and basically have a different lens for the camera, something that wasn't quite their intention, but can work as a camera tool. And we figured out a bunch of these different things that are in most games that we would be able to leverage in a capture environment.
So when you guys go to produce those kinds of trailers, do you have like a cinematographer and a DP, people who would use those tools in the outside world, or is that a different skill altogether once you get inside a game?
There's a lot of crossovers and similarities between the two. So we would call them our capture directors, and they are basically mimicking what a DP or a cinematographer would do in the real world.
Okay.
One of our partners and the creative head of our company, David Moody, you know, he's been with the company the entire time and is very familiar in everything that we do in the game space, but he is also our live action director. And in that way, there is that kind of crossover between the two, both the real physical cameras that we use for our live action spots, and then, of course, what we do in the games world as well.
I have to say, I really enjoy games trailers. I just like the cinematic ones are, I think, the coolest. I don't really like gameplay trailers that much, but I really like the cinematic ones, like this one that I'll put up on the site. But the Gears 5 one is really cool. So yeah, I feel like because they can get into the game world, you can really do some interesting things that you can't necessarily do with other properties because you don't have all of that groundwork already laid.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And, you know, for a game like Gears that does have this storied history, there is a certain amount of, you know, what we can fall back on. What do fans already know and love about this franchise? And we can build off that. We're not starting at zero. We're starting a lot higher than that. Now, granted, for this specific trailer, that's kind of who we're going for and who we want to bring in. There are other assets that are meant to start from zero and are meant to be more welcoming to fans who may not have played a single moment of the Gears game before. But like you mentioned, there are others that can kind of build off of what we would expect the fans to know and just end up with something that's going to ring a little bit truer and feel more authentic for those who really care.
Let's go back to something you just mentioned, or you mentioned a little while back, which was fan reaction. So let's say you've put out a trailer or you've rolled out a campaign and the fan reactions are rolling back in. So first of all, how do you track those reactions? Do you do that across all the platforms where you've rolled out the campaign and also like in forum group discussions? So that's one. And then two, once you get that feedback, how do you incorporate it into your campaign going forward?
So we have an insights and research team, and anytime that we release an asset or a campaign, we are tracking everything related to it, whether it's sentiment, whether it's actual reaction, or whether it's one of many gifts that people will post to Twitter
yeah.
after something is released, hopefully in a positive way. So we will track all of that and just kind of establish a baseline of how people are feeling about this, what they're liking, what they're not liking. And it really will span all of those platforms. Twitter's a big one, as people just are more communicative there. Instagram as well. And then forums are really where you can start to get deeper into the discussions from some of those core fan circles. And you can see, you know, how does this resonate with them? What do they like about it? What do they not like about it?
Yeah. And, I mean, and YouTube too, wouldn't it be?
Yes. YouTube as well. It's interesting. When you look at something like a Reddit or a Twitter or a YouTube, the types of comments and the level of detail that people get into really vary per platform. So YouTube is great for either it's usually a giant thumbs up or a giant thumbs down, but there isn't too much in the comments that's going to get in the weeds as to what specifically people are gravitating towards. But if you have the YouTube data and you can see when people jump off of the trailer, that gives you another type of information that we can use for future campaigns and future work.
Or you can go to Reddit and get like a 10-page thesis on what worked and didn't work about your trailer.
Exactly. And that is all too common. If you're working on a campaign that is going to last for a while, it's also essential. You want to know what people are liking, where their affinities lie within something. It's going to give you actual information that should absolutely be affecting whatever you're going to be releasing next. If people are all focused and talking about that they need to see more of the story, that they don't understand what this is about, then that should absolutely affect your story trailer that's going to come out soon. It's a little irresponsible to not be measuring that fan reaction. Now, of course, you don't want to overreact to that.
Yeah.
You don't want to take a huge left turn based off of what, you know, three people are saying on Reddit. So it's going to be a fine line, but regardless, it's something that should be paid attention to, whether or not you are acting on what you're seeing there, or whether or not you're just kind of logging it away to keep in mind for the next round. It's something that we at the very least try to invoke with all of the longer tail campaigns that we work on.
It's interesting too, because you said you have a whole team that gathers fan measurement. And I think when people talk about analytics, you think, okay, so you go to one dashboard and you see the analytics. But the truth is, it's an all-day gathering process of monitoring all these different platforms. Like, it doesn't just come in a neat package for you.
It really doesn't. There are services and products that you can use that will try and collate everything and give it to you in summary form. But I think in general, you're going to get the most accurate results if you can, you know, physically be the one going to the sites and reading the information and kind of incorporating all of it. It's a lot to do. It's definitely not the most time efficient way to do it, but I think your learnings are just a little bit closer to a fan's experience and where they want to see this go next.
Let's talk a little bit about community managers, so in the game world, you have, I'll talk about Blizzard because that's the one I know the best, but Blizzard will have community managers that will go out onto the forums and interact with people. And they're pretty active in these communities. How do you turn to the community managers, or how can you use them to help with marketing campaigns? And is that something that you find, not really so much campaigns, but marketing efforts? And is that something that you find the community managers are willing to do and are in tune with, or is that something that's evolved?
Yeah, I think community management is an underappreciated art form. I think the general perception of it and usage of it at some companies is kind of weeding out the trolls and you know, basically being someone to acknowledge that a fan has said something to you, whether it be positive or negative. But I think there's a lot more to community management than just that. And we as marketers need to be as informed about the community's affinities, likes, and dislikes as a social media community manager. I think it's vital to a campaign. There needs to be open dialogue and ideally flowing in both directions. In our experience with community managers, they know the audience, they know where things are headed, and that information needs to work its way into campaigns. Community managers often want to have this dialogue, and in our experience are more than open to kind of sharing their opinion based off of everything they've seen in the community. And I think we as marketers just need to continue to embrace that more and more.
I was just going to say, so they serve as kind of an intermediary between the community and the marketing team, almost as people feeding into this fan research team that you were talking about.
Yeah, basically that. They're going to have their finger on the pulse of this community more than anybody else. That is their job. And we should constantly be searching out that information and wanting that information to inform our campaigns.
Do you think there's a way to tap into that for TV campaigns? Or does it depend on the property?
Well, I think it does depend a little bit on the property, but more so it kind of depends on the length of the engagement and how much time that you have. We want to leverage the information and the insights that they bring. It's not helpful if your TV spot is you know, needs to be completed in a month. At that point, you kind of enter head down production mode. How do we finish this? How do we get this done in time? But then again, that's always the case when you enter rapid production mode and something just needs to get done. Ideally, even if it isn't a longer tailed game or series, there is some information and research gathering that can be done that will and should affect a TV campaign. It's almost like live focus groups. A lot of companies will engage in research and testing and focus groups that will affect the creative platform, which will then affect the TV spot. And how your community is reacting to what you've already put out there is basically, in quotes, free focus group testing. You're seeing how they respond. Now, granted, the people that are responding are a certain type of person, and they generally care a lot about this property in one way or another, but it's still basically free information that absolutely should be affecting a TV spot or a campaign.
I mean, I think it's interesting because I feel like I overuse this example, but again, with Game of Thrones, I think that was a show where, because it had the world built already and it had fan groups, and the show only accelerated all of that. So it was sort of able to tap into the kind of fan engagement that you're talking about with games that a lot of, I mean, I'm sure, like I said before, most shows would long for, but it's, you know, it's a lot of work and it's a lot of time to create that kind of world and that kind of fan base. And you really have to have something for them to grab onto, which I think is why a company like Amazon is doing Lord of the Rings, for example, or why it makes total sense that Disney Plus is doing The Mandalorian, because they're going to already tap into that IP and that fan universe that exists.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's interesting, the two other examples you brought up in both Star Wars and Lord of the Rings, these are big, you know, marathon IPs with just legions and you know, tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of fans who want to engage, who want to be part of this, what is now a pop culture conversation.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when we talk about something like Game of Thrones, we put it on par with those, but it wasn't that long ago that, at least it doesn't feel that long ago, that Game of Thrones was a virtual unknown. It is a fascinating example of an IP that has managed to kind of reach that upper echelon despite not having the length and history that a Star Wars or Lord of the Rings has.
Yeah, I agree with that totally. Looking ahead a little bit, what trends do you see coming up in these two spaces, in the game space and the TV marketing space? Like, for example, we kind of talked about this, but do you think we'll see more AR or virtual reality or augmented reality in marketing campaigns? Do you think there's a new social media platform like TikTok on the horizon? Anything that sort of that you see sort of coming up on a trend level out there?
So from a higher level, and I'll dig into this a little bit, I think there is a movement to almost go a little bit more niche, a little bit smaller, in order to get big and to become part of the fabric of pop culture and conversation. And I say that because as the main internet and social hubs get more and more crowded, unless you are a home run hitter, Star Wars is about to come out, then you as a brand need to go to a fresher territory in order to get your voice heard.
Yeah.
You see, traditional out of home is up for the first time in years and years. Experiential is getting hotter. I think AR and VR will continue to be effective for some audiences, but it's unclear when that install base, at least for VR, will be considered mainstream. So I think in general, what I'm noticing is brands moving to smaller events as the big ones get too crowded. Kind of constantly looking for where can we get ahead of where everyone else is at right now? That way we have our own moment. And on that topic, I think we will see more companies kind of holding their own events where they can control the programming.
Like D23.
As opposed to, like D23 is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
You know, Microsoft is about to have their XO event later this year. And you look at how E3 is still a massive beat where there's major announcements. But now if you're a smaller brand and you can't rely on breaking out of the noise at E3, then you're starting to look at, okay, so where else can we go? Maybe we still want to have a presence at E3, but how do we make sure that we're not going to be drowned out? Do we go to the Game Awards? Do we go to XO? Or do we have our own event? And do we host our own thing where we can control the content, control the programming, and make sure that our message is communicated out there clearly? I think Nintendo just had their Nintendo Direct earlier this week, where they had all of their own announcements. I think this idea of traffic and just constant fighting for attention in the entertainment space, which is inclusive of gaming, I think people are constantly needing to find ways to control the messaging and ensure that they're not going to be outshouted by a bigger IP than them. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, we also just saw Gamescom go by, which is in Germany. It's a big games conference. How do you think a event like that resonates in the gaming world? Or do you think that's one where it's so big that people can't get their message out?
It's kind of on that line. It is definitely a big moment in the gaming world, and there are a lot of announcements there. It used to be, I think, the kind of, you have an announcement at E3 or you have one at Gamescom. Mm-hmm. And if you're considering these 1A and 1B in terms of announcements, then it's getting to the point where it might feel a little big and a little crowded, which is a good thing. It's a sign of its success as an event and as a platform. But people and brands are looking for other areas in which they can just control a little bit more, make sure that they're heard, and not have to worry about being potentially just outspent during a period when people are spending a lot.
I mean, it's interesting because D23, which is Disney's big event, I mean, that in and of itself was huge. They had so many announcements across so many platforms, and it was only Disney. But so that, I mean, just shows you like how big, I guess, Disney has gotten. And then it's also interesting because Blizzard for, I don't know, at least 10 years has done their own event, BlizzCon. So some of them have already started doing this.
Exactly. Yeah. You see it with the bigger players out there. They've already kind of made that move and made that transition. So I think the question becomes for some of the smaller players who might not have the kind of structure and the web that someone like a Disney or a Blizzard has, you might not have enough content to host your own event and create a moment. So where do you latch on to next? What are the other kind of smaller ones that are friendly to independents or just smaller brands, and how do you insert yourself there? I think this idea of going niche to go mainstream, as backwards as that sounds, is going to see more and more traction as Disney launches their service, Apple launches theirs, more and more, and others and others.
Also, you mentioned before the pop culture conversation, which is sort of an aspect of the internet world that I really like. Like, I like that I can find it, like learn about a new show or learn about a new movie or tap into the early Oscar conversation via different pop culture conversations. As a marketer, do you think that brands will try to, because I think part of the appeal to it is to that is that there's an authenticity to it, but do you think brands will try to kind of get in there so that they can get mentioned in the pop culture conversation? Do you think there's an attempt for marketers to get in there and manipulate it?
I think that I think that already exists. I think people are definitely trying to kind of tap into that broader conversation and attach their brands, their IP, their show to this broader discussion. I think it's everyone's hope and dream for their IP to become mainstream and to effortlessly flow into that pop culture conversation. But for those brands who aren't quite at that level yet, I think it is a large part of marketing strategy of how do we become part of this conversation? Is it by attaching ourselves to something, or is it by doing something so big and so crazy, or so great that we know we're going to get those eyes.
I think one thing that's interesting about that, taking it back to the community manager, is I think that's also part of their job.
I agree. And it's their job to, yes, at the very least, have tabs on it. And if you broaden the definition of community manager to the marketing team and the agencies working on the campaign, which ultimately that is what is helping define, you know, what this community is and what this community is reacting to, then it's absolutely the job of the community manager to know where things are headed and determine how their brand can get involved with something like this, or at the very least, you know, mentioned adjacent to it in a positive light.
Okay, so I'm getting toward the end. Is there any, I know that a lot of times this is touchy, so if you can't, it's no problem, but is there any other campaigns or anything you guys are working on at GNET that is coming up that you can or want to mention?
I know we've talked about a number of campaigns already. We've got some pretty interesting campaigns for Netflix that are coming soon that I can't unfortunately talk about yet. Mm-hmm. But I will say we're also leading the campaign for E! for the People's Choice Awards this year. There's some awesome work that's dropping this week and then in the weeks to come. I think the high level view of what we're doing there is that for a show like this, that's all about the fans. That's literally the definition of the People's Choice Awards. Our campaign is also kind of leveraging those fans and bringing them into the campaign in a way that feels very natural and authentic for a show like the People's Choice Awards and might not fit quite so well for some other award shows, but really speaks true to the fans and the DNA of a show that really puts those fans on a pedestal.
Yeah, that's a really good example of TV and fandom coming together. So that'll be cool to see what you guys come up with.
Yeah, we'll be sure to send you some links.
Yes, please. All right. Well, thank you so much, Nico. I appreciate it and have a great day.
Perfect. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, we'll talk again soon. Bye.
All right. Talk soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Paige Albiniak is editorial director of Promax. Andres Trujillo, Promax's social media and community manager, produced this podcast. Video Helper provides the music. Digital content producer Kayla Marie Hardaway contributes to Daily Brief. Promax has rebranded to just Promax, so you can find us on Promax Global on Facebook and Promax_Global on Twitter and Instagram. You can also always reach out to us at dailybrief@promax.org, and you can subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.